He found about a dozen and asked the chiefs, schoolmaster, and parson which of these were quick studies. They named three, and that made 64. A scholarly old fellow showed up who lamented the fact that no one would be writing the history that would become legend. It turned out he was the dean of literature of a sort of underground university that had been eking along for centuries, and on the argument that he had two capable replacements for himself in the school, and, due to his age and poor health, was expendable anyway, he could not be left behind by the MacTyler. Robert the Fox thought that very necessary, so that made 65. 18 outright, uncontestable ties had shown up in the contests the chief had arranged, and when it looked like blood would be spilled over it, Johnny gave in, and that made 83. He woke up Turl, who had been hitting the Kerbango pretty heavily since sunset and was lying like a mountain across the plane seats. "We have 83," said Johnny. "The plane takes 50 cyclos, and 83 humans won't occupy that space or make up that weight. I want to make sure you do not object to 83. Turl was foggy and sleepy.
"The casualty rate of such a project is high. We have to make it appear that they are just training all winter when they are operating, so the extra numbers are fine. Why'd you wake me up for a silly question like that, animal?"
And he went back to sleep. Johnny had culled another piece of Turl's project from this. Up to now, he hadn't any real hard data on Turl's plans. "Praise all for Kerbango," thought Johnny as he went off. He had the historian draw up a roster of the Anguses and Duncans and all their parade of names, and sent them off in the night to hasten pell-mell to their homes and get heavy and light clothing and sleeping blankets, personal gear, and a few days' worth of food to tide them over until he could round up cattle. They must be back at dawn, and those who didn't have them borrowed horses, for in some cases it was a long ride both ways. Johnny had a final meeting with the chiefs. "We have caused quite a row up here in the highlands, and although the local mine site is 500 miles away, it would be a good thing now for your people to be quiet and undemonstrative for the coming year." The English lord thought that was a very good idea. The chiefs agreed to it. "There is a distinct possibility," said Johnny, "that we will fail, and that I will never see you again, and the group will be killed." They brushed this off. Brave men always risked death, didn't they? And they'd not blame MacTyler. The bad thing would be not to try. That would be what couldn't be forgiven. In the midnight chill, Johnny talked to those who had not been chosen, thinking he would leave disappointment there. But he found the chiefs had already told them that when the mission succeeded, they would be a recovery corps in charge of policing and reorganizing England, Scandinavia, Russia, Africa, and China, and they were already scheduling study, training, and organizing to do that at the end of a year. And the non-chosens were wild with enthusiasm. Thyrgus was spokesman as he calmly outlined it to Johnny. It worked on a clan system, of course.
"My God," gaped Johnny, "these Scots thought big."
"Don't fret, MacTyler. We're behind you."
Johnny, exhausted, stretched out under the fuselage of the freighter, wrapped in a woolen blanket hand-woven in the tartan of Clan Fergus, and fell into a hopeful sleep. For the first time since the death of his father, he did not feel alone. Chapter 7 1 The first trouble came from Turl. He had a hangover after his solo binge, and he had been irritated close to anger at the comings and goings and delays. At first light, Johnny began to load them as they arrived singly and in groups from their errands to their homes. The people in the meadow had not left, but had slept on the ground around fires. No one was going to miss the departure. More Scots, having missed the gathering of the clans due to distance or infirmity, had come in, and the number had doubled. Johnny began showing them how to tie down their gear in the military supply locks of the personnel freighter, and how to fasten themselves into the seats, two to a seat, and adjust the belts. He had gotten about six, fully settled, when two of them promptly got out of their seats again and started showing newcomers where to stow their gear and how to handle the belts. Some apologized for seeming to bring so little, but times had been hard, they said. It was no longer safe to raid in the lowlands. Some thought perhaps they were bringing too much, but one never knew, did one? Some were a bit late and streamed in a breathless rush, the historian worriedly checking off their names. The old women came in a clatter of kettles. The parson arrived rolling a keg, in case someone became ill. Johnny strapped it down tightly, curious. He had never seen whiskey before. The sun was getting higher. Turl roared from the cab, "Get these filthy animals loaded." People became very quiet. Johnny winked at them and they relaxed and got loading going once more. Finally, they were all there, all 83 of them. Johnny said, "This flight will take several hours. We will go very high. It will be very cold and the air will be thin. Endure it somehow. If you feel lightheaded, it will be from lack of air, so make an effort to breathe more often. Keep yourselves tightly strapped in. This plane can turn in all directions and even upside down. I'm now going to the forward cab to help fly this thing. Remember that one day soon many of you will also be able to fly machines, so observe things closely. Robert the Fox is in charge here. Questions?" There wasn't one. He had made them more confident in their new environment. They seemed cheerful, not afraid.
"Take it up, McTyler," said Robert the Fox.
Johnny waved at the crowd out of the side door and they roared back. He slammed and locked the door. He settled himself in the co-pilot seat, wound the security belt around himself twice, put on his air mask and got out the map. Turl was looking sourly at the crowd. With vicious sudden gestures, Turl recompressed the cab with breathe gas and ripped off his mask, and Johnny saw his amber eyes were shot with green. Turl had been going heavy on the Kerbango. There was an evil twist to his mouth bones. He was rumbling something about late and having no leverage on these blasted animals and teach a lesson. Johnny stiffened in alarm. The plane vaulted skyward at a speed enough to crush him into his seat. It was at 3,000 feet in the wink of an eye. Johnny's map and hands were pressed painfully downward into the co-pilot control panel. Turl's talons snapped at some more buttons. The ship started over on its side.
"What are you doing?" shouted Johnny.
"I'm going to set an example," roared Turl. "We've got to show them what will happen if they disobey."
The thick mob in the meadow was a small dot below them as the plane turned downward. Suddenly, Johnny knew that Turl was going to blast them. The ground came screaming up, the crowd getting large.
"No!"
screamed Johnny. Turl's talons were reaching out for the fire buttons. Johnny heaved the map. Open, it pinned itself against Turl's face, cutting off his vision. The ground was coming up with speed. Johnny hit his own controls with staccato fingers. 200 feet up, the plane abruptly changed course to level. Its inertia sucked it down to only yards above the crowd's heads. Like a javelin, it shot forward. Ahead of them, the trees leaping larger, was the mountainside. Johnny's fingers stabbed keys. Branches hit the underbody. The plane rocketed up the mountainside only feet from the ground. It shot into the clear as they passed the mountain crest. Johnny leveled it and stabbed it at the distant beaches. He reversed the tape that had taken them on the incoming voyage and fed it into the autopilot. The sea sped by only yards below them. They were in the clear, undetectable by any mindsight observation post, heading for home. Johnny, bathed in sweat, sat back. He looked at Turl. The monster had gotten the map off his face. Flames were flickering in his green-shot eyes.
"You almost killed us," said Turl.
"You would have spoiled everything," said Johnny.
"I've got no leverage on these animals," snapped Turl.
He looked over his shoulder to beyond the cab rear wall.
How, he added with nasty sarcasm, do you intend to keep them obedient? With little baby toys?
They've been obedient enough so far, haven't they? Said Johnny.
You ruined this whole trip for me, said Turl.
He relapsed into moody silence. At length, he rubbed at his aching head and fumbled around for his kerbango. He brought up an empty container and threw it down. Johnny clipped it into a rack so it wouldn't go adrift. Turl found another one under the seat. He chewed off a slug of it and sat there gloomily.
Why, asked Turl at length, were they cheering yesterday?
I told them the end of the project would see them highly paid, said Johnny.
Turl thought that over.
Then, they were cheering because of pay?
More or less, said Johnny.
Turl was suspicious.
You didn't promise any gold, did you?
No, they don't know anything about gold. Their currency is horses and such things.
High pay, eh?
Said Turl. He was suddenly very jovial. The kerbango was taking effect. He had just had a wonderful thought.
High pay.
He knew exactly the pay they would get.
Exactly.
At the muzzle end of a blast gun. He cheered up enormously.
You fly this thing pretty good, rat brain, when you're not trying to kill everybody.
This struck Turl as very, very funny, and he laughed from time to time all the way home. But that was not what pleased him. How stupid these animals were.
High pay indeed.
No wonder they'd lost the planet.
He had his leverage.
He'd never heard such enthusiasm.